Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion about the war on the poor, declared this week at a fiscal summit in New York, presided over by a billionaire deficit hawk who is championing the Ryan budget and promoting the belief that our fiscal woes are the result of too much spending on programs that help the middle class and the poor, and that these programs should be cut to reduce the deficit. Gary Rivlin, the co-director with Barbara Ehrenreich of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and author of Broke USA, joins us. Then we'll look into the just-released report by the U.S. Census Bureau that finds white births are a minority in America, with children from racial and ethnic minorities for the first time now accounting for more than half of the births in the United States. Mark Mather, a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau, joins us to discuss the divide between the older white population with the votes, money, and power, and a growing young population that is foreign to them. Then finally, Toby Miller joins us in the studio. He is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His latest book is Greening the Media, and we will discuss the dirty secrets that hide inside our favorite electronic devices, debunking the myth that information and communication technologies are clean and ecologically benign, while arguing for waves to make the media greener. And joining us now is Gary Rivlin, who's a journalist and author of five books, including Broke USA, and he's the co-editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, along with Barbara Ehrenreich. And early in his career, he covered Harold Washington's Chicago. Studs Terkel said of him he was to the Chicago political scene what I.F. Stone was to the national picture. And of course, Chicago is back in the news, front page story in the New York Times today, saying that a billionaire in Chicago who owns the Chicago Cubs is now financing a hit job against Obama, bringing up the Reverend Wright, etc. So the billionaires are loose in this country. And recently it was pointed out that in terms of the 99% versus the 1%, the actual figure is that this election is being bought by the 0.00063%. So far that appears to be the case. Why is it that America is controlled by billionaires who are in your face? They're running a 1%er for a president. And there isn't, apart from you and Barbara Ehrenreich, I don't see a lot of people standing up for the poor.
Yeah, you look at our electoral system, and 10 or 20 years ago, I would have said it really favors the very rich, and it just keeps on slanting that way. You've got Citizens United and super PACs, and the laws have loosened so much, or they've created all these opportunities for billionaires to just spend unlimited amounts of money. It used to be hard, right? You had to kind of find a guy who was willing to bundle a lot of $5,000 contributions because there were caps on that. But with super PACs, you know, some rich casino mogul in Las Vegas can talk about morality through Newt Gingrich, give him $10 million. I mean, it's really gotten absurd, and that's where that stat comes, that it's, you know, what was it, 0.0001649, whatever you just said, that they're just putting hundreds of millions, if not, you know, millions, if not tens of millions, into these super PACs. Preposterous.
And the billionaires met on Wall Street on Monday and Tuesday, hosted by multi-billionaire Pete Peterson, where they all attended what was called the Fiscal Summit. And it was an extraordinary collection of rich white guys who basically are acting like they're the adults in the room, and that the greatest problem facing the United States is the deficit, which incidentally George Bush largely ran up with unfunded wars and crashing the economy. But leaving that aside, you had Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner there, House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House John Boehner, along with former President Clinton, all being hosted by former Nixon Commerce Secretary turned hedge fund billionaire Pete Peterson. I'm sure he was paying them all handsomely to attend. And this, again, I find mind-boggling, that these wealthy white men are basically saying to America, our biggest problem is that we have this abstraction called the deficit, and that the only way we can solve this thing is, and I mean, what's really implied here is that the poor and the middle class have been just getting away with it for too long. They're living in luxury with all these wonderful benefits from Social Security and Medicare, and we simply just got to stop this profligacy. I mean, it's an amazing narrative.
You know, I'll have to confess, I went to the summit last year, and I walked away thinking, okay, he's putting the spotlight on an important issue. We do have to worry about the deficit, and you know, he's talking about an important issue. But this year, I mean, that he just came out and said the answer is austerity again, as you said it well, like as if they're the adults in the room. I mean, let's look at who's paying the fair share of taxes. Let's look who's not paying their fair share of taxes. I mean, that's the crime here. That's what I wish that the Pete Petersons of the world were coming out and saying, like Warren Buffett is saying, there are billionaires, there are rich white guys who are saying precisely the opposite. Yes, we need to get this deficit under control, but the answer is that, you know, the top tax rate right now is 35%. I mean, in the 60s, in the early 60s, it was 70% or more. We need a couple of more tax brackets, that the person who's making $250,000 a year is different than the person who's making $2.5 million a year, who's different than the person making $25 million a year. And we just need to have more brackets up there to make up this deficit. The other thing to say is, like, you know, I do agree that we need to deal with the deficit, but any economist is going to tell you, a moderate economist, some conservative economists, if they're being honest, is that you don't implement austerity during a recession, that government spending is just basic economics 101, that you need to, you can't rein in spending in a recession because you're just going to make the problem worse. I mean, that's what's happening in Europe, and it kills me that we're talking about doing the same here.
Again, I'm speaking with Gary Rivlin, journalist and author of five books, including Broke USA. He's the co-editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with Barbara Ehrenreich. And we're talking about a new study that came out today an article by Barbara Ehrenreich and also by Gary Rivlin. Barbara's Looting the Lives of the Poor. And Gary's article is America's Poverty Tax, how we're in fact taxing the poor. Now, the point that you just made, Gary, I think is at the heart of the presidential race, in the sense that this 1% of Mitt Romney is portraying himself as the adult in the room. He's the businessman, the successful businessman, and he really knows what's going on. And of course, he's calling for austerity, and he supports the Ryan budget. And this, the billionaire hedge fund, Pete Peterson, who's corralled all these people, and he's been spending a lot of money to get the word across through think tanks, etc. And it's been successful. A lot of Americans, particularly the middle class and working Americans, have bought this ridiculous idea that, you know, it's just like the household debt analogy, you know, that we have a debt that's unsustainable, and we've maxed out our credit cards, and we've just taken on too much debt. And as a family and a household, we've lived above our means, therefore we all have to tighten our belts. But in this case, only the poor and middle class have to tighten their belts. The people on Wall Street are allowed to loosen theirs and run roughshod. The need for economic literacy in this country couldn't be greater. You just pointed it out. It's economics 101. If you're in a recession, you need to stimulate and prime the pump, not turn off the tap. And we've seen what's happened when they've done that in Greece and Spain and in Britain, and they're calling for it here. And that the only way to get revenues here in the state of California, we're in a terrible shape because the revenues aren't coming in. The only way to get revenues to come in is to stimulate the economy so people have money in their pockets, they spend money, you create demand, and then very soon, once you get the whole economy up and running, you pay down the debt, which is actually what Clinton did in his era. So who's going to make these economic 101 arguments? Are they too complicated for the electorate?
I mean, I don't think so. And by the way, I'd go a little bit further. I mean, you look at the Ryan plan, which Mitt Romney has embraced, so you can call it the Romney plan as well. I mean, to the extent that they put up specifics, the deficit would widen under their plan. Yes, they would slash the safety net so they'd save money, but they want to slash income tax. I think Romney, if I'm remembering the details right, wants to lower taxes by, 10 percentage points for each bracket. So the people paying 35% would pay 25%. That's just going to destroy our federal budget, and by extension, to use the Pete Peterson argument, is just going to make life that much harder for future generations. So that's a shame. But, you know, I mean, the campaign hasn't really started. I mean, I do have faith that this isn't going to be a winning argument. I do optimistically perhaps think that Romney's embracing of the Ryan plan will hurt them. That's too radical for people. I'd like to think, and I think the polls back me up here, that the average American realizes that both things have to happen. That, yes, we need some cuts, but it's not fair. It's not fair that Mitt Romney paid 14% to taxes, and me, you, and most people out there paid 35% in taxes. People get that. And I'm convinced. And again, a lot of the billionaires, you've got Gates and Buffett, et cetera, out there talking about this problem. So, you know, maybe I'm just a bit more optimistic than you on that front.
Well, I'm basing my observations on what's happening on the Hill, what's happening with Ryan and Cantor and Boehner, and now Boehner's threatening to do another debt ceiling meltdown and hold the country hostage for another Tea Party tantrum. and that there again, that's all based upon this bizarre ideology that, I mean, you can't deny that we do have a debt, and it's now the servicing of the debt, by the way, is the third biggest item on the federal budget. But of course, the debt is owned by the rich and the poor service it through their taxes. And since the Mitt Romneys of this world don't pay anything like what they should be paying, the poor have to do a disproportionate amount of servicing of the debt since it's a compulsory payment.
So, and here's where Aaron Reich's essay, Looting the Lives of the Poor, is so brilliant, because, you know, what governments have had to turn to is like, well, let's make people pay for their own court costs. Let's make people pay for their own jail cell. Let's make people pay for petty crimes, which calls to mind that famous quote that, you know, the laws making it illegal to sleep under a bridge affect the rich and poor alike. You know, that there are all these different fees that government has come up with that disproportionately hurt the poor. And, you know, you look at it, how much money do we spend on the war of poverty? How much do we spend on TANF, the new AFDC? How much do we spend on SNAP, the new food stamps? And yet, with the other hand, take money out of people's pockets. I mean, Popper's point is like, well, at least let's stop doing harm. You know, we could talk about what programs we need to have, what's working, what's not working, but let's first stop doing no harm. Then you look at private business. You know, there's a study out that says that wage theft, you know, the employers taking from the pockets of their employees, amounts to $100 billion a year. You know, cheating the waitress and waiters out of their tips, that kind of stuff. I read about all these businesses that are soaking those living on the economic margins, those who don't have enough paycheck to last the month. They go to the payday lender, and the average payday lending customer is paying $500 or $600 in fees every year. You know, these people making $20,000, $25,000 a year trying to get by and paying these fees that work out to an interest rate of 400% a year. You look at rent to own, they charge twice, 2.5 times for the same item at the rent to own shop because people have lousy credit. They can't buy it on a credit card. And you know, they need the bedroom set for their kids, and so they buy it on time, essentially, and pay 2.5 times as much. So there's almost like a poverty tax. Check cashers. The average check cashing customer spends $900 a year at a check cashier. I mean, again, $20,000, that's like almost a 5% tax that you're paying because you messed up your relationship with the bank, you bounced too many checks, you can't have a bank account anymore, and so then you're falling prey to the corner check cashier. And so those are the kind of things we're trying to look at, like, okay, let's figure out ways we could stop harm from being done to help the poor, on top of the ways we're spending money as a government.
Well, you know, Gary Rivlin, again, co-editor with Barbara Ehrenreich of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and we're talking about not just the group of white men that met in New York City Monday and Tuesday for Pete Peterson's fiscal summit, where they are basically telling the nation that the biggest problem are the deficits, and that the poor and middle class have been getting it too good, and the only way to cut the deficit is to stop the spending on Social Security and Medicare. And this is being reflected even broader in terms of their priorities. The defense budget, you know, was a part of the sequester. It was going to be automatically cut if they couldn't make a deal. The Republicans signed on to the sequester, and now they're refusing to cut the defense budget or allow the automatic cuts to come through, insisting these cuts instead have to be taken out of food stamps, etc. So there you have it. It's just, we're not making this stuff up. They have made it incredibly clear what their priorities are. What right-wing welfare is fine, agribusiness, defense spending, unlimited amounts of money, stuff that actually helps human beings, forget about it. It's appalling.
Right, right. The list of their cuts on a deal that was already made, I mean, that's what steams me. I'm curious how this is going to play out over the coming months. There was a deal. We all saw the deal being made, and they couldn't come up with an agreement, so automatically there's supposed to be these cuts. And now the House, the Republicans, are refusing to abide by the deal. I don't know how that plays out. I mean, it seems so obvious to me that, wait a second, there was a compromise. It was a deal. It's done. And for them to just walk away, I have to think that if this ends up being a winning argument, I just don't know what to say about the media coverage. I mean, I kind of get the feeling that the mainstream media is so scared of just saying what they see with their own eyes that it's just all too subtle, that it's like competing talking points, and the anchor just shrugs, like, well, who knows, those crazy idiots in Washington, they never agree on anything.
Right.
But I really do think we just have to have more reporting on what is going on. There was a deal. We all saw it happen. The Republicans are now walking away from that deal. That's what's going on now. But instead, it's sort of like this, wow, look at this amazing fight going on, round three of, you know, the Republicans versus the Democrats.
Well, last time around, when the Tea Party zealots were blackmailing to get their way in this political tantrum, where they're willing to put at risk the full faith and credit of the United States government, which they succeeded in doing because we got downgraded as a result of their antics, it was so clear that that was a one-sided situation, that the people who were holding a gun to the nation's head were the Tea Party, yet the mainstream press, NPR, of course, get their money from the government. They're terrified of offending right-wingers. The mainstream press, all of them basically treated it in that convention of equal time. Everything's equal and opposite, black and white. There are always two sides to everything. And it totally fails to really portray exactly what happened. They are incapable of taking a stand or telling the truth. And it's really appalling. And it's going to happen again if Boehner goes ahead and has another tantrum and shuts down the government.
Right, right. Yeah, okay, so now that you've depressed me and everyone else for the day.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, though, the mechanism behind this, and maybe this is a way to focus people in on why they've got to pay more attention to what's going on and take back their government. The lobby for the payday lenders is one of the more powerful lobbies and one of the more persistent lobbies on the Hill, and it's a bipartisan disgrace, but mostly Republicans. The other lobby that's equally obnoxious is the for-profit college racket. And these are both similar in as much as they both prey on the poor. The payday lenders that you've talked about and the 400% interest, you'd think that they'd be run out of town, but instead they've got a lot of traction on Capitol Hill through their lobbyists. And the for-profit college people who prey on minority students and vets who want to get an education and saddle them with huge debt, all of which, you know, they take public money, and 90% of their funds come from the taxpayer, and they charge it back to these kids at usurious rates and indebt them for life and give them a worthless diploma, and they can't even get a job, and they never will, and they'll never be able to pay off this mountain of debt. That is the face of these bottom feeders who are entrenched in Washington. So, you know, you think that that's so flagrant, we ought to go after them.
Well, you know, I know more about the payday lobbyists and the various fringe financing lobbyists. I mean, the pawnbrokers give money. I mean, all these different businesses that charge triple-digit interest rates on loans have their lobbyists in D.C. Now, there's been legislation proposed for at least 4 years, maybe more like 6 or 7 years, that would have a national usury cap. Most states in this country have a cap on interest rates, 15%, 20%, 30% a year. And the payday lenders spending money on lobbyists went state by state by state and got an exemption from the usury caps. Oh, these are just emergency loans. Let's not make them fall prey to the these usury caps. And legislators, Dick Durbin, you know, powerful senator, number three ranking senator, I believe, among the Democrats, has legislation that would say, let's just have a national usury cap. 36% annual interest rate, that's a lot of money. That's a nice big cap. And let's make every business abide by that. But legislation gets nowhere. Again, the number three ranking Democrat in the Senate has introduced this legislation. He's behind this legislation, and it doesn't get anywhere because it's not just the Republicans. The Democrats are getting money from, you know, the various fringe financial institutions. And, you know, on top of that, you know, the banks. The banks in 2011 set a record for the most amount they've ever spent on lobbying. I mean, a typical bank at J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citi, you know, they're spending $2, $3, $4, $6 million a year on lobbyists. And guess what? Wells Fargo is now in the payday lending business. I mean, they don't charge 400, 450%, but they're still charging 200%. They're still charging like astronomical rates on their payday, their short-term loan. I don't think they use payday. You know, their short-term loan product. And so, you know, they too are there in D.C. lobbying for the freedom to charge whatever they want. Credit card companies. If you ever wondered why you pay your credit card bills to, it's typically to Nevada or South Dakota, because those are two states that have no usury cap. So what happened? Citigroup, Chase, etc., they all set up their credit card operations in those states, so there'd be no cap on what they could charge for interest rates. So I'm sitting in New York right now. I think our usury cap is 16%, but I can have a credit card that has me paying an APR of 30% a year, 40% a year, because technically this bank has their credit card operations in South Dakota, Nevada, Delaware is another place that doesn't have a usury cap.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Gary Revlin.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Revlin, who is a journalist and author of 5 books, including Broke USA. He's co-editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with Barbara Ehrenreich, and he covered Harold Washington's Chicago. Studs Terkel said of him, he was to the Chicago political scene what I.F. Stone was to the national picture. And he has an article at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project's website, America's Poverty Tax. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the U.S. Census Bureau report that whites are becoming a minority in America.
You need it, that's for sure.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Mather, Vice President of Domestic Programs at the Population Reference Bureau, where he coordinates population research to advocacy groups, educators, the media, and the public. He has authored more than a dozen reports on the well-being of children and families and has co-authored five population bulletins on U.S. demographic trends, and he leads a project to investigate the characteristics and geographic distribution of scientists and engineers in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Mather.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And the U.S. Census Bureau have just issued a report saying essentially that children from racial and ethnic minorities now account for more than half of the birth in the United States, meaning that for the first time in the history of the United States, white births are in the minority.
That's right. So we've been seeing rapid increase in racial ethnic change in the United States. And this is just, so we knew that this was coming for some time, but it shows that children are really at the forefront of the racial ethnic changes that are taking place.
And you believe that there's a connection with the economic downturn?
Well, I would say that if anything, the economic downturn may have dampened this increase a little bit, because what the downturn did is it reduced immigration to the United States. So we've had fewer immigrants, especially from Mexico, arriving into this country, and therefore fewer potential parents with children in the United States.
Well, my understanding, though, is that the U.S. Census report says that U.S. birth rates have been declining, but the drop has been larger for white people.
Yes, in terms of the birth rate, there has been more of a decline among, in terms of the number of births, we've seen fewer white births than among other groups. It's not entirely clear whether or not that decline in white births is due to the recession. We think that there is a link there. It's a combination, I think, of both the fertility trends and the trends in immigration, because it's young people who are coming here to work, and young people who might be returning to Mexico. And when you've got a lot of young people, those are the people who are having the birth. So I think it's a combination of both the fertility trends and the recent trends we've seen in immigration.
But apparently the figures are that the number of white births have fallen by 11.4% since 2008 compared to 3.2% for minorities.
That's right, and that's largely due to the aging of the white population. So we have all of these baby boomers who are now reaching retirement age. So that means that there's a lot fewer people of reproductive age in the white population, essentially. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's fewer births per woman, but there's fewer couples who are having kids, and therefore you see this decline in white births.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Mather, and we're talking about the U.S. Census report just out indicating that white births are a minority for the first time in U.S. history. U.S. history. I mean, there were Native Americans here before the white men. I suppose that's not an entirely correct statement of mine. But unfortunately, you know, they were pretty much wiped out by the white man. So, what we just talked about, though, I think is really interesting, Mark Mather, and that is that there is a growing division here between an older white population that have the votes, the money, the political power, and basically get most of the benefits from the government, and then you've got this younger population that is foreign to the older white baby boomer and older population, with whom they have no personal connection.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's what we call it. We call it a new generation gap. So we have lots and lots of baby boomers. They're now reaching age 65, they're going to be eligible for Social Security and Medicare benefits, taking up a large part of the federal budget, making those entitlement payments. And then you put that in contrast with this younger generation that is increasingly Latino and Asian and multiracial. And so you have this interesting juxtaposition of these two groups who, you know, may not... I think there's some culture shock involved in terms of these two groups getting together and getting to know each other. And for government, it's a matter of public policy priorities. Where are they going to spend their money? On which populations are they going to devote their resources?
Well, at the moment, in terms of Social Security, of course, that is designed to take care of older people, and it just happens the majority of them are white. Medicare takes care of older people as well, right? And much of the expenses in the last few years of their lives. So the system is already rigged in terms of money to take care of the elderly.
That's right. Yeah, so you'd have to, there are proposals, I guess, that Congress are considering to make some changes to those programs, but really those expenses are built in.
So again, Mark Mather, we're talking about the U.S. Census report came out the first time white births are a minority in this country, and Mark is president of domestic programs at the Population Reference Bureau. The nation's minority population is now 36.6% of the population, right?
That's right.
And Hispanics are the largest number of that. That's 16.7% of the population, total of 52 million in the United States as of 2011.
That's correct.
And then you've got the next biggest group, 43.9 million African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And
Latinos past African Americans in the past decade is the largest minority group.
And the report also sort of breaks this down on a national basis, doesn't it? There are four states: Hawaii, California, New Mexico, and Texas, plus Washington D.C. where minorities are a majority.
That's right.
I mean, we're going to have to stop calling minorities minorities, right?
It's a strange term, this majority-minority term, but that's the only term that we've come up with so far.
So do you think that the Hispanic population boom has peaked?
Well, it remains to be seen whether or not we have seen a recent decline in Latino growth, and also for Asian Americans, there's been a decline in their growth rate. So they're still the fastest growing groups, but they're not growing as fast as they were during the past decade. So it remains to be seen whether this is a short-term trend, maybe in response to the recession, or whether this will be a longer-term trend. And I think it's too soon to tell. But as the economy bounces back, we could see a big increase in immigration, for example, that could boost those numbers again.
So is there a relationship between the numbers of minorities in states and the quality of state services?
Between the number of minorities and the quality of state services?
The reason I brought that up is that California used to have the best education system in the world. The envy of all the other states, and then basically it's now down almost at the bottom with Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And some people have argued that in its storied days when it was first started, the University of California, et cetera, it was almost entirely white, and now it's largely minority, and it's just basically been defunded. So mm-hmm. I'm just trying to get in a sense of whether this is a trend that's maybe national, that the more the population of schools become minority, the less we're investing in them. And in other words, there's a white flight to private schools, et cetera.
Right. Well, it's a very complicated issue, and I think it does have to, it does, I mean, you have to look beyond just racial and ethnic composition to the number of disadvantaged students, low-income students, which is closely linked to educational outcomes. And so there are definitely big challenges for states that have large numbers of low-income students or students in single-parent families, which happen to correspond often with racial ethnic composition. So I think those correlations that you're talking about do exist, but the relationship and causality is often complicated.
So, Mark Mather, at the Population Research Reference Bureau, do you look into the other factors like how these demographic changes are affecting our politics? Because it seems to me that that we have a minority president in Barack Obama, and never before have we had more poisonous discourse on race. So it seems like a disconnect to me. The more the country it becomes this sort of rainbow coalition, the more strident and poisonous is the public discourse about race relations.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we're sort of at a turning point in this country in terms of, you know, we've had a long history of immigration to the United States. So more than many other developed countries, we accept immigrants coming here. But at the same time, you know, Barack Obama's ratings are clearly much higher for the younger generation, who is much more used to seeing that multiculturalism growing up with other students in their schools who are of different racial ethnic backgrounds. So again, it gets back to this culture shock, I think, with the, especially the older white generation that just didn't grow up in their cohort with racial ethnic minorities. It's going to take some getting used to.
So just in closing, Mark Mather, what about how this is going to translate in terms of voting? The older whites who are becoming the minority do have the political power and the money and the votes. But I take it that and African Americans have fought hard for their vote, and they tend to be amongst the highest voting levels in the country. There's been some puzzlement as to why the Latino numbers have not been as high as they could. I take it they're bound to grow.
They will grow over time. There are the fact that many Latinos lack citizenship has been one of the barriers, but every single year we have a growing number of Latinos who were actually born in the United States. So as we get more Latinos who are second generation, third generation, we're going to see the political power of Latinos really increase over time.
Well, Mark Mather, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Mather, who's the Vice President of Domestic Programs at the Population Reference Bureau, where he coordinates population research to advocacy groups, educators, the media, and the public. He has authored more than a dozen reports on the well-being of children and families, has co-authored 5 population bulletins on U.S. demographic trends, and he leads a project to investigate the characteristics and geographic distribution of scientists and engineers in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break, and culture critic Toby Miller will be joining us in the studio.
Poor boy, head against a pillow, fast asleep. Poor girl, head against a window, lost in dream. But one day they will be as giants, stronger than the sun. But that day ain't yet come.
Maybe get a blister on your little finger. Maybe get a blister on your thumb. We got to install microwave ovens. Custom kitchen deliveries. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color TVs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me in the studio is Toby Miller, who is the chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. After working in broadcasting, banking, and civil service, Toby Miller became an academic in the late 1980s and went on to become one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. In this month, he becomes the director of the City University of London's Centre for the Study of Cultural and Creative Industries. His books include Technologies of Truth, Cultural Citizenship and the Popular Media, Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, and his latest book, just out, co-authored with Richard Maxwell, is Greening the Media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Hi, Ian. Great to be back. Yeah.
Even though what you're talking about here is that a lot of what we assumed about the technology that, it's easy to hate the Koch brothers, and it's easy to love the late Steve Jobs, as many people do. They see Silicon Valley and the products they make as being virtuous, and there's no question how malignant the Kochs are. But there's another story to this. I mean, we heard about the working conditions in China that make the Apple products. Some of that was overstated by a non-journalist. But on the other hand, there's no question that there's a lot of truth to it. What you're talking about here in the book is about the enormous amount of e-waste that's going on and the incredibly toxic nature of it.
Oh, that's right, Ian.
Among other things.
Yeah, we go back and try to give, if you like, an alternative history of the media so people can rethink the beginnings of the print medium, you know, going back to Gutenberg in Germany centuries ago, right through to what happens with our cell phones today. And really there are, I think, three aspects that we look at. One is questions of manufacture. In other words, what are the environmental impacts and the occupational safety and health impacts on the wider ecology, but also on the workers who manufacture everything from the news, from this radio program, through to cell phones. Secondly, what are the costs ecologically and the impact environmentally on individuals of use of these technologies? And thirdly, what's the impact later on in their, if you like, post-consumer existence, their post-use afterlife? And that is what's often referred to, especially in the United States, as e-waste or electronic waste. As you said, lots of us have become aware in the last 6 months, round about the time of the hagiographies that were being written and spoken of for Steve Jobs at his passing, of the appalling working conditions of people employed by Foxconn, which is a large Taiwanese firm with over 1 million employees, most of them in mainland China, who make iPads, iPods, iPhones, and all the other gadgets that you and I, or certainly I, love. We're all aware of that. And I think we're equally aware of the conflict minerals war in Congo, where part of the civil war and the horrendous things that go on between militias and the general population.
5 million people died.
5 million people died go on because of coltan, which is this mineral that's essential for cell phones and other products. And a lot of the guns that are run and bought by the militias are made available as a consequence of the sale of these minerals to other countries. And they enslave very young boys and girls to work in the mines to generate them. People are somewhat aware of that. There's a jointly sponsored piece of legislation that's gone through the Congress about it in the last couple of years. So those are the two big ticket items that we know about. But the story is deeper and wider than that. Yeah. If you go back to when you and I were young, Ian, which obviously from our accents was in another country and obviously from looking at us was many decades ago, the place currently occupied in the restaurant table by the cell phone was occupied by the packet of cigarettes. Literally, they're placed in the same location. Literally, they're used for the same purpose. When people are bored or waiting or on their own or demoralized, they used to light a cigarette from the little box that was on the left or the right of them on the restaurant table. Now they pick up the cell phone. Now, what's interesting is that regardless of what one thinks of the content of those conversations, because I certainly have conducted mostly trivial conversations for the 50 years that I've been speaking English, regardless of what one thinks of the content, I don't think there's any doubt that we're at a moment when, in terms of health concerns, not only the manufacturing componentry of cell phones, but also their use, is leading to great controversy. I mean, one study says one thing, one says another, but there are lots of suggestions, unsubstantiated so far, that cell phone use can expose users to all kinds of dangerous substances, and that in particular, not just the electromagnetic fields, but also the Wi-Fi systems that we now have as part of our everyday lives everywhere we go, including here in the KPFK studios, may have invidious health effects. Now, as I say, the jury is out scientifically and medically on this, but the fact is it's not inconceivable that in 20 years' time, the kinds of things that are said now about the health impacts of those cigarettes sitting next to you 30 years ago on the restaurant table will be accusations leveled at the cell phone sitting next to you in front of you at the restaurant table.
Well, but what's wrong with, you know, having a conversation? I mean, why text, you know, instead of talking to somebody? That's what worries me, is that we'll become we're becoming less social beings and more isolated and not introspective, but just isolated.
Yeah, insular.
That's the word I'm looking for.
I understand that argument, Ian. On the other hand, one can say that, particularly with the new systems that allow you to include large numbers of people within your texting regime, it in fact becomes possible to share your somewhat personal private thoughts, share where you are and so on with large numbers of people, and then they can pitch in as well. So ideally, one could argue that this is a way of expanding one's social horizon rather than diminishing it. I understand your skepticism. I just want to suggest that there's another side to the argument as well.
Right. Well, I know. I am afflicted by this thing called LinkedIn. I don't know how I ever got into it.
Oh, it's a shocker.
And every day I get people are saying, you know, accept me as their friends or something, and I don't know who the half of them are. And
they're all masseurs.
And then when I reject them, when I don't respond, people think I'm sliding them. So, you know, you're being automatically cast as some kind of social climber on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you're being automatically cast as being unfriendly. And this is all imposed upon you by some goddamn machine.
Well, some of it's a machine, and some of it's about software and inventive businesses.
Well, I'm in the industrial age, obviously.
We're in the midst of this extraordinary opportunity, in inverted commas, for people essentially to buy shares in Facebook from Mark Zuckerberg and his friends, who are dumping them on a cruelly unsuspecting public.
Right, and one of them's avoiding taxes by living in Singapore.
By ceasing to be an American,
right.
God damn it.
And Chuck Schumer went after him today. And of course, I just saw a clip from Fox News where they were defending this guy, saying that the government was trying to take away his money. I mean, that's amazing, the stuff that you hear on Fox News.
But listen, one of the stories about Facebook that matters to me in terms of this book, for what it's worth, in the case of Facebook, obviously there's the concern about the way in which our interpersonal interactions are being corralled in the name of corporate intelligence, corporate knowledge of everything we do. I appreciate that. There's also the fact that in order for it to service its hundreds of millions of users, Facebook, just like Google, just like all the big enterprises, is using massive server farms all over the country and all over the world. These server farms are what you might think of in the analog era as being very large telephone exchanges, but they're the things that are necessary in order to power and to circulate all the information and communication technology we use, whether it's a cloud, or whether it's getting software updates from Microsoft, or whether it is getting intelligence from Google. All of these require massive amounts of electricity. Now, in some cases, some of these companies are careful to use alternative energy sources. The vast majority, however, this applies to Apple and all the big corporations we're talking about, are utilizing either coal-fired or nuclear systems, in most cases coal-fired. So one of the hidden costs of what seems to be a lovely green industry, without all the obvious pollution you get from manufacturing or that we get when we drive around here in Southern California, is actually contributing massive amounts of greenhouse gases and other problems to our local ecology and our ecology right around the globe. So there's another side to this. It isn't just about whether we gain or lose from the sociality of Facebook or the sociality of the cell phone. There's also the fact that there is the hidden environmental impact that is absolutely integral to what they do and largely hidden from all the rhetoric.
And all of these TVs and flat screens and computers and the rate of obsolescence is extraordinary. And a lot of them are dumped in the third world, aren't they?
Well, this is a big part of the story. As everybody, I'm sure, knows, 2 or 3 years ago, we all had to get rid of our fat screen TVs that were the old analog ones and get our brand new spanking flat screen digital TVs. Now, again, there are some technological developments that are changing this, but by and large, the lovely flat screen digital TVs have required 3 times the amount of electricity as the old ones to run them. Not only that, but they also exude more heat, which often means, particularly in warm climates and in summertime, that people are utilizing more air conditioning while watching the flat screen digital TVs. So there are all kinds of impacts that come from that, quite apart from the fact that it's sometimes been argued that the television, the manufactured object is the hardest manufacturing device of all, including cars, boats, anything you name, to recycle. And as you say, where those do get recycled is another story we can get onto in a second. And the other thing then about a mega event, say the Super Bowl,
right,
or the World Cup final, right, or the Champions League game that's coming up this Saturday, is that because vast amounts of people are all watching television at the same time, that means they're also breaking at the same time, especially in a game that's relatively uninterrupted,
right,
like a football game, i.e. a soccer game, right, where, you know, it's going to be nonstop for 45 minutes. That means that after 45 minutes, everyone's going to the toilet, everybody's boiling the kettle,
right,
everybody's opening the fridge. Well, of course, that means there's a massive power surge, a massive power rush.
Right.
So in countries where you're seeing simultaneous blasts, not only from the TV, but also in terms of the national grid, when it comes to these other events occurring every 45 minutes or every hour, you have to plan as somebody on the grid for these incredible surges. So, yes, I mean, one can be a real killjoy when talking about this, but I think it's very important for us to be responsible consumers, citizens, workers, you name it. So by all means, enjoy Bayern Munich really showing it to Chelsea at 11 a.m. Pacific time on Saturday. But as you do so, you know, turn the lights down and keep the air conditioning on. This year, it looks as though for the first time, expenditure worldwide on consumer technology devices will be $1 trillion. Last year, worldwide, $993 billion.
Mm.
Now, bodies like the Consumer Electronics Association here in the U.S., which represents the major manufacturers of these devices, says, you know, this is wonderful. It's a consumer's love affair with technology. Bodies that are pro-growth, like the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, say, well, when you have less developed or emergent economies that don't have effective national grids and don't have effective conventional landline telephone systems, isn't it marvelous that people who are conventionally disenfranchised and without communication are able to utilize, for instance, cell phones? And I don't want for a second to deny that there are benefits that flow from these, nor do I wish to suggest that I don't participate in them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I benefit from many of these devices. But I want us to be a little more aware of some of the costs as well as the benefits. Let me get back to the TV for a moment, if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Just across the border from where we are in Southern California, in Tijuana, in northwestern Mexico, there are, as many people will be aware, some listeners may have worked in these places, maquiladoras. Now, Tijuana was, in the early part of this century, just 7 or 8 years ago, the television set manufacturing capital of the world. As a consequence of lots of competition from Vietnam and China, and then some further problems, obviously, with the global recession, the number of TV sets made there in comparison to those other places went a little bit down. But right now, it's still about a third of the TV sets that come into the United States. The mostly women who are on the production lines for the big electronics companies, making not only TV sets, but let's focus on that for the moment, are working for well below the minimum wage here, are operating at very high levels of productivity, are reporting extraordinary degrees and levels of sexual harassment, are experiencing all kinds of fertility problems, birth defects, sickness, nausea, you name it. And just to get back to the consumer issue, if they were to buy one of the TV sets that they have made in Tijuana, it would cost them more than if their aunts, uncles, friends, or any of us bought the same TV set over the border in San Diego because of the way in which tariffs don't apply to products that go from Mexico to the United States, but do when they go in the other direction. There's lots of hope. There are lots of positive stories, and I think it's great if we devote some time to that. First of all, in terms of the positives, one of the incredible ironies, let's think about Fox News Channel, not a station probably that a lot of KPFK listeners are prone to enjoy, and I certainly don't as an individual. Nevertheless, remarkably enough, 5 years ago, Rupert Murdoch, the head of News Corporation that owns Fox, held his first ever global meeting of all employees, a virtual meeting in many cases, to talk about the 600,000-ton annual carbon footprint of the corporation. And he said, and I quote, "We must get our house in order." And he said that there must be a comprehensive program of offsets and decrease in emission of greenhouse gases by Fox, such that it hopes this year, 2012, actually, to have a zero carbon impact. Take the extraordinary vigilante right-wing TV show 24, very popular across the world for many years. The first ever carbon-neutral primetime US TV drama because of that initiative. Fox News Channel, populated, it appears, by climate change deniers, but actually powered by some of the greenest media technology in the world. So that's just
my
one.
God, that's amazing. So Murdoch is doing it at the technical level.
Yep.
And Ailes is still pushing global warming denial across the airwaves.
That's about audience targeting. You know, the people they target are not very educated, not very wealthy, very angry, not very urban, very white, very male people. And those are many of the climate change deniers in the United States. Remember, Murdoch is much more interested in money than power. And so are most of his disciples. Yes, they have ideological commitments. Right. But what matters most of all...
He knows how to spread money around in order to corral power, particularly in the United Kingdom.
We know about that. And it's not only about Fox. In fact, all the major studios, Warner Brothers was a prime mover in this, have got green initiatives that are quite significant. But what about the things that we can do as ordinary people, as consumers, as workers, as citizens, you know, in those three often overlapping, sometimes distinct roles that we have? On the one hand, we're the people who buy this stuff and who use it at work as well as at play. On the other hand, and I've always got three hands, we're the people who make it and who are part of the systems that utilize it. And on the third hand, we're the people who are part of the world environment in which it takes effect. So what can we do? Well, I'm pleased to say that gradually, slowly, right across the United States, thanks to citizen agitation, almost every state now, it's more than two-thirds, have enacted legislation. We have some in California to try to deal with this problem. So that's one area. Keep being the pressure on local governments and state governments. The second thing is put pressure on the federal government. We do not follow the Basel Convention, which is the major convention that prohibits the export of these substances once they've been finished with.
You know, you mean the waste products?
The waste products.
The e-waste.
The e-waste that goes principally to China and India, but also to Mexico, to Brazil, to Nigeria, you name it, and has extremely deleterious effects, horrendously deleterious effects on those working on it. Similarly, be militant about the fact that many of our federal prisoners who work for Unicor, the sort of federally owned monopoly company that is the employer, in inverted commas, of essentially slave labor in our prisons, mostly black men and brown men, African-American and Latino men, they are doing unsafe recycling of all these computer gadgets as part of their prison duties. So there's an impact we can make at home. There's an impact we can make by requiring the big companies like Apple, but not only Apple, like Hewlett-Packard, for example, to make absolutely transparent where their products are made, how their products are made, by whom, and what happens to them in their post-consumption life. It's essential that these corporations be the ones made ultimately responsible for the ecological and occupational health and safety impacts of what they peddle, not us as consumers. It's really crucial we do that. And there are lots of interesting non-government organizations, social movements, activists you can get involved with. I mean, just to mention two, the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, set up in Northern California, very important in dealing with these questions. And Greenpeace has done fantastic actions. They regularly appear at Apple's trade shows and make very strong activist statements about workers' conditions, but also about the ecological impact of all those lovely gadgets.
This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Farhad Mohammed. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.